I'm sure everybody remembers this earthquake. It occurred just this year, and there was considerable footage on the television, so everybody should now know just what a great earthquake can do, even in a country which is heavily reinforced for earthquakes, such as Japan. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about this earthquake because there's so much online that all of you, please go out and look at this stuff, and it's just a terrific example of every aspect of the earthquake hazard problem. So, what we need to ask is this going to happen again? How frequently? These are 21st century issues. If you think back just over the last few years, there have been three horrendous earthquakes which have caused exceptionally large loss of life and damage. These are the 2004 Sumatra earthquake, which killed 250,000 people all around the Indian Ocean coast, and also the 2010 Haiti earthquake, which razed Port-au-Prince to the ground and resulted in more than 300,000 people being killed and an equal number severely injured, who now have to be looked after all their lives. So, is this just coincidence that we've had these three horrific earthquakes just in the last 10 years or so, or is something else going on? This gives some clue, some insights into what's going on, because this is a map of the Earth with all the cities larger than 1 million people pre-1600 marked. And you can see there's quite a smattering of them. Many of them are around the Mediterranean and some in East Asia. And if we roll the clock forward 350 years, we see that there are many, many more of them. In fact, in this plot, the yellow dots are cities with more than 2 million people. And there are even some mega cities with more than 8 million people. So that's the difference that 350 years can bring. But if we just roll the clock forward another 50 years, we see a completely different picture. The Earth's population is mushrooming. We're in a steeply climbing exponential state at the moment, and megacities are springing up all over the place. And if you cast your minds back to the configuration of plate boundaries, in particular subduction zones, which is where the largest and most damaging earthquakes occur on Earth, you'll see that there's considerable resemblance between the pattern of subduction zones and the pattern of where all these megacities are. Okay, so this slide shows earthquakes with more than 10,000 fatalities over the last 1,000 years. And you can see that there are quite a lot of yellow dots, that's more than 10,000 people dead. And there are a small number of red dots with more than 300,000 people dead. Okay, so this is over the last 1,000 years. But now, just in the last 6 years, 7 years perhaps, we've had two earthquakes which have caused approximately this number of deaths. There would be two more red dots added to this just in the last 7 years. So the problem is, of course, that the megacities are growing up in earthquake-prone zones. Here's what world population is looking like. So this is a plot of world population over the last 1,000 years and projected into the future. You can see that for most of the time, for most of the last 1,000 years, up to about the year 1800, world population has been up to 1 billion. But just in the last few decades, it shot up to what it is today, which is 7 billion. And it's projected to rise to 9 billion by about 2050. So that is within your lifetimes. So clearly, when an earthquake hits nowadays, it hits a great city. That great city has not just got a population of a few hundred thousand, it's got a population of millions or even tens of millions. So clearly, the damage, although the earthquake may be similar to ones that have happened in the past, the impact on humans is going to be that much bigger. And if you add to that considerations of global interconnectivity, the stock market, and this kind of thing, then it's clear that a very damaging earthquake in one part of the world, even if it's not felt in any other part of the world, could have a serious impact on everybody's lives. Okay, so instead of rolling the clock forward, let's roll it back and look at some of the basic fundamental principles that you need to have in mind in order to study this socially relevant problem. 1906 in San Francisco. This is what San Francisco looked like in 1906. And these city squares here, with a complete lack of houses in between, just a grid of roads. This is not the municipal area marking out areas to be built on, but this is San Francisco, what it looked like immediately after the 1906 earthquake. So where is all the rubble? Okay, so most of the city was not destroyed by the earthquake itself, but the earthquake resulted in fires breaking out, and San Francisco was unprepared to deal with fires on the scale that occurred, and the whole city burnt down. There's an interesting little story about that, and that is that the inhabitants of San Francisco, they were keen to build up their city to become more populous, more rich and more powerful, and they didn't want it to become widely known that there'd been a terrible earthquake. They thought this might put off new settlers. So there was a certain amount of propaganda put around saying that San Francisco had been damaged by a fire and there hadn't been an earthquake at all. So obviously this is not true. This earthquake is extremely important because it enabled geologists and geophysicists like myself, I'm a geophysicist, it enabled us to understand for the first time what caused earthquakes. So nowadays, of course, it's kind of daily bread. We know that earthquakes are caused by sudden slip-on faults. But there was a time back then when that wasn't known. And it only became known because of the fortuitous confluence of this great earthquake, this 1906 earthquake, which caused extremely regular deformation on the surface of the Earth, and the presence of a geologist called H.F. Reed. H.F. Reed was a geologist who had spent his life studying geological faults in the Basin and Range province over in Nevada and Utah. So he was very used to looking at these beautiful normal faults, seeing large displacements and seeing evidence in the fault zones itself for one block of rock sliding past another. And he walked a long way along the fault break of the 1906 earthquake, and he saw features everywhere which looked like this here. So here we have a very clear example of how one side of the fault has slipped past the other. We have a fence displaced. This is now a tourist attraction, so if you go to California, go and check out this famous locality. And H.F. Reed saw this tremendous zone of disruption striking straight across the landscape where one side had slid past another. So he then concluded that this is what had caused the earthquake. So these three slides illustrate the situation. Bonk, the earthquake has occurred, sudden slip on this fault. The fault has not cracked slowly, centimetre by centimetre, as perhaps was thought before. A lot had happened at once. And these displacement features are seen. This next slide shows a few features of seismograms, so a little bit of basic information here. This is in fact a time series, and this shows the time series of ground motion for the great Sumatran earthquake of 2004, which caused the devastating tsunami in the Indian Ocean. It starts off with a relatively small wave, the P wave. Anybody who has felt an earthquake might have noticed this, that the first thing that you feel is a kind of rattle, high frequency rattle. Not the strongest wave, relatively small compared with what's coming. And a little bit after that, you get a stronger wave, which seems to be longer period. It's more of a swaying wave and it moves things from side to side. So when you feel that, you had better get to safety, because before very long, the real business is going to start, and that is the arrival sometime later of the very powerful surface waves. And you can see that in this seismogram here, where the extremely high amplitude waves come considerably later than the P and the S wave, if you're at some distance away, that is. So it's the surface waves which sway the ground from side to side very, very powerfully. These are the ones that do the damage. Okay. So if you're caught in an earthquake, P wave first, then S wave, and then you know something much worse is on its way. So get under the table, secure anything that needs securing, turn fires off, get children and elderly people protected so that you're braced for when the most powerful wave comes along. Here we have maps of global seismicity, just briefly to remind you that you know, these are the zones to be worried of, and here again you can see that the main zone of seismicity is around the so-called Pacific Ring of Fire. The black dots are shallow earthquakes, the green are intermediate depth, and the red very deep. And these green and red ones have the potential to be the largest because they're occurring at greater depth. So, if you like, they can tear greater areas of fault surface. And you can see that a lot of them, as I say, cluster around the Pacific Rim and also the Himalaya Alpine Belt and through Sumatra. So, just think of what cities there are there: San Francisco, Tokyo. You could make a list of more of these. These are the hot spots where the most potential for destruction, the most danger, really to not only to human beings on the spot, but also to the global economy exists. And you may well live, I may well live, in our lifetimes to see some pretty impressive disasters happening in some of these places. So, we're now going to move on to the effects of earthquakes, and I've divided them up into two categories for you. Okay. So we're going to talk about environmental effects, and we're going to talk about effects on humans. So try to keep these clear. So if you have a question in an exam that says, you know, name X number of environmental effects of earthquakes or something like this, you don't lose marks by writing down human effects. Okay? Environmental effects are things like groundbreaking, landslides, effects on the environment, things that would happen even if human beings didn't exist at all. Whereas effects on humans are things like nuclear power stations being damaged, bridges falling down, fires breaking out, things which occur because there is human infrastructure there. And you know, if the same earthquake occurred in a desert where there wasn't anybody, then you know, this would not occur. So I've listed 8 environmental effects, and we'll go through these one by one, just mentioning a few words about each. So first of all, ground shaking. This slide maps out the San Francisco Peninsula area, and the different colours show some indication of the competence of the ground. You can see that around San Francisco Bay, Robin Hood's Bay, a lot of the land area is coloured in red. And this indicates bay muds and fills, which are water-saturated sediments, very poor quality, very poor material to build on. So these are there for a reason. When California was first settled, there was a gold rush, and people were very greedy, and they weren't concerned with environmental issues, and probably nobody, you know, had got that concept in their minds back then. And a lot of gold mining was done with the so-called hydraulic mining approach, where people trained powerful fire hoses on river banks, and they washed tremendous volumes of mud and silt, completely destroying the river banks, washed it into the river, and then they could pan it and get the gold out. So down the Sacramento River, which runs into San Francisco Bay, a tremendous torrent of mud and loose sediment flowed. And after some period of this, it became clear to everybody that the bay was silting up. The bay was eventually going to be lost. And it's the presence of the bay which makes the climate in this particular area particularly benign. It's nice, it's sunny, warm, doesn't get too hot in the summer. San Francisco is known as the air-conditioned city because the bay gives it a nice microclimate. Much of the rest of California is a blazing desert. It's a desert with rivers running through it, people say. But this San Francisco area, this area around the bay, has got a beautiful climate. And this was going to be lost, so this hydraulic mining method was banned and stopped. But still, we'd partially silted the bay up and around the rim there, all these bay muds and fills, and of course, people weren't aware of earthquake issues back then, and they built up on this area. So, build on the red areas, and it's bad news in an earthquake. And the green is, let me see here now, the yellow is somewhat more competent material, the green is better still, and the blue is bedrock. So the amount of ground shaking is going to depend on what kind of material you've built on. This is the Cypress structure. This was damaged in the Loma Prieta 1989 earthquake, which is what we're going to be studying for the practical. This is a particularly horrific thing, really. When this earthquake struck, it was only magnitude 6.9, and it struck up in the hills, so it didn't actually do a huge amount of damage. There was damage, but the funny thing about this earthquake was how irregularly kind of distributed the damage was. There wasn't a huge amount of damage in the epicenter then reducing as you went out. It was a much more complicated pattern than that. And that's why it lends itself very nicely to the practical exercise you'll be doing. So here in San Francisco, the Cypress structure collapsed. This was a motorway, and the cars traveled in one direction on the top and in the opposite direction on the bottom. And all of these things are supposed to be built earthquake-proof. And the shaking wasn't that strong, but still it collapsed. So then it was a question why it collapsed, and of course they went to pull the blueprints out, only to find that the blueprints had mysteriously disappeared. So there's always the suspicion that this thing was not built up to the correct specifications. But anyway, the top layer just collapsed down on the bottom layer, just squashing all the cars underneath, the flat as pancakes. So of course people were instantly killed in a horrific way, but there were these sections where bits were just, hadn't quite pancaked down, and people were trapped in their cars, although they hadn't been killed. So of course the fire department, I think there can't be many groups that are more heroic than American fire departments. They're the first port of call if there's any disaster of any sort, and they are there instantly if you call them. And anyway, they hit the Cypress structure there and they immediately went about trying to pull people out. And the aftershocks after this large earthquake were coming over, and they were shaking the Cypress structure. Every time a large earthquake occurred, the Cypress structure would shake, and there were all these firefighters in here trying to pull people out with the structure continuing to collapse around them. So there are some incredible stories of heroism that came out of this, and really very moving. Anyway, the US Geological Survey set up an early warning system where, because the main shock was some distance away, so the aftershocks were also some distance away, and it took several tens of seconds for the surface waves to travel from the epicentral distance to the Cypress structure. So they set up a warning system there, and when they detected a large aftershock, bells would ring on the Cypress structure, and the firefighters had time to get out of it before the surface waves from the large aftershock came over. So everybody just scrambled to deal with this horrific situation. Okay, there's a phenomenon called liquefaction. If a soil contains some water and is shaken up in an earthquake, it starts to behave a little bit like a jelly, and it'll sort of flow. Let's run this again, shall we?
This is known as liquefaction, and this is showing a laboratory illustration of this. This is the box of sand, wet sand is being shaken. And you can see that the little model building is sinking right into the sand there, and this tank that pops up, this is supposed to represent something like a petrol tank at a petrol station. So if buildings and other infrastructure are built on material of this kind, which is saturated in water, then that is not good news in an earthquake. And there are many examples of what happens when this is the case. Probably most of the people in this building survived. It just toppled over like a Lego brick. The third thing that can happen, the third natural environmental effect that earthquakes can cause to happen is landslides. See that the whole of this side of this hillside here is just flopped down here, and there are 28 people under that landslide because it flowed down onto a campsite. It was such a huge landslide it was not practical to try to retrieve the bodies. We think quite a lot about ground rupturing, of course. You know, if there's ever a cartoon or anything like that about earthquakes, then there's always a great big gash in the ground. But in fact, that's a rather relatively minor source of difficulties, really. And I had to look around a little bit to find a convincing slide which showed that this was a real problem, because usually it isn't a real problem. Okay, you might get a few meters of movement, but it's not really what's going to cause the biggest disruption. Here in New Zealand, there was some minor inconvenience caused by this. Aftershocks. Because we can't predict exactly when an earthquake is going to occur, scientists are moving away from putting their efforts into trying to do that, and they're focusing more on things that they know they can do. And one thing we do know, that when there's a great earthquake or a large earthquake or indeed any earthquake at all, there will be aftershocks. And these aftershocks can be as big as one magnitude unit smaller than the main shock. So if you have a great earthquake magnitude 9, you're almost certain of getting several more earthquakes of magnitude 8, and lots of 7s and lots of 6s. And of course, these are quite big earthquakes. If you have a magnitude 8, you'll probably get several 7s afterwards. So you've probably noticed, for example, after the Japanese earthquake, that the media from time to time reports that a large aftershock has occurred. Well, this is going to go on for 50 years. This diagram shows how So here we've got a main shock occurring here. Here it is. There's a little foreshock, and there's a main shock. And then after that, there's a sort of quasi-exponential decay over a long period of time as aftershocks occur. And the bigger the main shock, the longer this period. If you have a very big main shock, like 8 or 9, then, as I say, it'll last many decades. So in the Tohoku area of Japan, there'll be earthquakes occurring there as aftershocks to that great earthquake for the rest of the lifespan of everybody in this room. Flooding can occur because large earthquakes will change the level of the land. You may have heard, it's put out in the media quite a lot, about the Tohoku earthquake, that the reason the tsunami topped the tsunami walls was because the land was dropped down. Maybe the case in some places. But anyway, the level of the land relative to sea level can change, and then of course you could have a nice little harbour like this with kind of hive of economic activity, and that could just simply be completely wiped out because the land has sunk. And you can get ground deformation even when you're away from the coast, as very nicely shown by this fence, which wasn't built like that. And of course, we should all know quite a lot about tsunamis. So prior to 10 years ago, tsunami was quite a rare thing that people hadn't really heard of in Europe. People knew about them in Japan because they're a big problem there, but not over here. Now all the world knows what a tsunami is. They can be incredibly damaging, and they've cost many, many, many thousands of lives in the Pacific. And of course, this recent 2004 one occurred in the Indian Ocean. It caused a tsunami that filled the entire Indian Ocean basin and killed people as far away as Africa. And the reason it was so horrifically, such a horrific loss of life is because they don't have an early warning system. Scientists know how to deal with tsunamis. Tsunamis take a very long time to cross ocean basins, maybe 20 hours. So you have a big earthquake here, and maybe 15 hours later it will reach the coast here. So obviously there's plenty of time to warn people. And this has been done in the Pacific Ocean for years. So when I was called up by that newspaper reporter in 2004, and he asked for some comment, the first thing I said was, this shows the importance of having a tsunami early warning system in the Indian Ocean. So of course there is one now. Tsunamis are caused by earthquakes which occur under the ocean. So here we have a subduction zone. I'm sure you're familiar with this from earlier lectures. And when a great earthquake occurs on a subduction zone, the subducting plate jerks down all at once by several meters. So this can cause a variety of deformation on the seafloor. You can have a situation where the subduction zone is going down and it's kind of bent. Okay, this is the subduction zone. So this part of the seafloor, okay, has bent down like this. And when it suddenly slips in an earthquake, it pops up again. That's quite a common thing to occur. But anyway, whatever is happening down there, you have suddenly got a displacement of the sea floor on a fault that may be 500 kilometers long, and there may be an area which is 100 kilometers out from the fault, which is all affected. And this is either going to pop down suddenly or it's going to pop up suddenly. So the entire water column above this enormous area of sea floor is suddenly displaced. So you can easily imagine that it's just going to go up and down like this, and this is going to excite waves which travel at hundreds of kilometres an hour and cross the entire ocean basins. Out in the open ocean, if you were in a boat there, you would not notice them because the amplitude of wave motion would be quite small. And the wavelength is hundreds of kilometres, so you just simply wouldn't notice it going by. However, when these things approach land, they slow down and they catch up on themselves, and then their amplitude can rise up to tens of meters. And when they hit the land, well, you know, you don't need me to elaborate on what can happen because we've all seen it on television now. Scientists have now developed very sophisticated computer programs for modeling these. Scientists can put an earthquake of any magnitude in to any part of the subduction zones anywhere on Earth, and they can predict how high the wave motion will be, what direction it will travel out in, how it will be focused in amplitude and so forth, and what the amplitude of motion will be, what the amplitude of the tsunami will be arriving at any harbour in that ocean basin. This is a model of the Sumatra earthquake. And this is a model of an earthquake occurring in Chile and crossing the Pacific Ocean. So here's Hawaii, just about to get it. You can see that there's a focusing effect just here. And that highly focused part is going to hit Japan. And the whole thing, as I say, it takes some 20 hours to cross the Pacific. So scientists set up a tsunami early warning center in Hawaii, and there's a miserable windowless office there filled with pathetic geophysicists who don't have lives, who are hanging over computer screens, just counting earthquakes all day. And if a so-called tsunamogenic earthquake, an earthquake that is likely to cause a tsunami, occurs anywhere in the Pacific Rim, then a warning is sent out. And in particular in Japan, there are tsunami warning sirens in every harbour. And if a tsunami is expected shortly, then these sirens go off and everybody leaves the harbour. And there's been a total collapse of fatalities due to tsunamis in Japan ever since this system was put in place. This was a kind of tour de force. It's a great triumph of geophysicists because so many people have been saved in Japan, which used to just suffer terribly from tsunamis coming in and people not being able to run away fast enough to escape them. So, if you see the sea go out, you know, you start running immediately and not towards it. Because by the time it's turned around, you know, and gathered itself up and it starts to come in, you know, probably all of these people are dead. It's just, anybody who's done any whitewater kayaking or anything like that will know the power of water. It's not something that you can just surf and escape from. So let's move on now to damage that is done to humans. And there again, I've categorized them to try to give you some framework to remember. Critical structures are the most important things, really. If you have a dam failing, this dam almost collapsed in 1971 California earthquake. If the dam had completely collapsed, the reservoir would have emptied itself downstream and it would have killed tens of thousands of people in towns downstream. Now, collapse of these structures are not just killing one or two people, but they can kill many tens of thousands. And this is a new slide I'm showing for the first time in this lecture because I used to show a slide of the Chernobyl nuclear power station which melted down in a fire. And I used to tell classes that this could happen in an earthquake, but I don't have to do that anymore because it now has happened in the Fukushima nuclear plant in Japan. And this is a catastrophe in a densely populated country where there isn't really enough room for the people that are there already, that you know, if a huge area suddenly becomes contaminated with radioactivity for several decades, then it's a national disaster. Buildings collapse, we know that. They say that earthquakes don't kill people, but buildings do. If you like to wake your colleague up, I don't like students sleeping in class. What would you do if I went to sleep? Okay, this is a hospital in California. This is a hospital, and this here was a part of the hospital which was on the side, okay, and that contained the stairwell and the elevator shafts. And this part just peeled off the building, plonk. So everybody in this hospital were marooned up there. The fire department had to come and bring cherry pickers to get people out of the windows. So obviously, if you're in an earthquake-prone place, you know, the building design needs to be smart. You know? The building didn't collapse, the patients weren't hurt, but they were marooned up there because the elevator shaft peeled off. Here we have lots of Japanese engineers taking photographs of this because whenever something like this happens in California, California is mobbed by Japanese engineers who want to come over and research what has happened so they can make their own country safer. However, if the street outside the hospital looked like this, of course the fire department would not have been able to bring its fire trucks up and rescue all these patients in the hospital. If the city had been such that there were lots of statues and various decorative items and so forth, which just simply peeled off the building and filled the streets with rubble, then obviously the rescue authorities, the firefighters, can't get down there to do anything. And if a fire breaks out like this, then you just burn. And this happened in Kobe in Japan in 1995. I had just come home from a conference there. This earthquake occurred shortly afterwards. What a narrow escape. I might not be here lecturing you today. I'll lead too dangerous a life. But anyway, Kobe caught on fire, and the rescue people couldn't get in because the streets were just completely packed full of rubble. So the fire, the city just burnt uncontrolled. Must have been like the Great Fire of London. That was what did most of the damage, just like in San Francisco. And filling the streets with rubbish is not the only way to destroy communications. This is extremely spectacular here. So there again, this kind of looks almost comical, but if the ambulance is here and you're hurt over here, then that's not such a great thing. And this sort of thing can cause tremendous disruption of everybody's lives for weeks until it's cleared away and fixed. There was the great earthquake of Kobe that damaged Kobe. I don't think it was a great earthquake, it was a large earthquake. It was particularly harmful to the entire nation because Kobe was an extremely large container port, and a very big percentage of all of Japan's imports of food and this kind of thing came in through the Kobe container port. And all the cranes here are the cranes prior to the earthquake, and here are the cranes after. This was just all completely destroyed. And parts of the harbour changed in elevation, so they didn't form good harbours anymore. So this was actually quite a significant national problem because all of a sudden this stuff couldn't be imported. So there were various estimates as to how much the Kobe disaster cost, and numbers like 10% of GDP for that particular year spring to mind. So obviously it's a huge blow to the entire nation if something like this happens. And of course, this is just mentioned for completeness. Tsunamis can just completely raise an area like no other natural phenomenon can really do. After the tsunami, you can't even see where the different city blocks were. So we'll just finish with a few words as to what can be done. This all sounds very black. There are things that can be done to mitigate hazard. We can't yet predict earthquakes. There have been examples where earthquakes have been predicted and lives have been saved, but this can't be achieved on a systematic basis yet. But what we can do is to assess risk. So here again is California, and here is the San Andreas Fault Zone. And geophysicists have drawn up maps where they map out the areas where they think the strongest ground shaking could occur. And they try to calculate the probability that a certain amount of ground shaking could occur within a 100-year period. This is the kind of information that engineers want. If an engineer is going to build a building, the engineer goes to the seismologist and says, how strong could the ground shaking be, and what is the probability of that ground shaking occurring over the next, say, 50 years? Because then the engineer can take decisions about how strong to build that building. So this is quite an art now. The Tsunami Warning Center, this is the pathetic little black hole of Hawaii that I mentioned earlier. I'm sure it's been spiffed up now that tsunamis are much more important, but it used to be. Can you imagine working in here with no windows in Hawaii? Some of the greatest heroes that save the most lives are definitely unsung. This is the Pacific Tsunami Warning Center. And here's another example of how sophisticated things have become tsunami-wise. As soon as a large earthquake occurs in the Pacific, it's going to immediately be inserted into a computer program. And before the tsunami has gone 100 kilometers or so, estimate of how much ground motion there'll be at all these different places can immediately be produced and broadcast to the relevant authorities. So here we have one in the Southwest Pacific, and this is Hilo in Hawaii, and I see that 16.2 centimeter tsunami is predicted there. And as we go down here, we come to places in California, Monterey, California. I can't read that from here. What does it say? 15.8 centimeters. So this is essentially instantaneous. information, so you know, it's, there's been a big advance in what we can do to mitigate tsunami problems. And engineers can design buildings that won't fall down. This is the Transamerica Pyramid in San Francisco, and this building will not fall down. It doesn't matter if there's a magnitude 8 or a magnitude 9 earthquake locally. This building will not fall down. It can be done. Just needs the money and the will. Even if you just live in a modest little house, there are things that you can do to build that house stronger. And the codes, in, certainly in California, are extremely strict. You can't build a dog kennel there without having all sorts of inspections done, because people don't want a lot of loss of life there. And indeed, when large earthquakes occur in recent years, that has not occurred. California was so burnt in more ways than one by the 1906 catastrophe that they're more or less determined it's not going to happen again. Even older buildings can be retrofitted. Okay, so you don't have to tear down historic buildings, you can strengthen them. And I think this is the last example, and this is the Alaska Pipeline Triumph. The Alaska Pipeline crosses the whole of Alaska and bringing oil down to the conterminous USA. And it crosses a large fault called the Denali Fault. And when the engineers designed this crossing point, of course, they went to the seismologists, they went to the geologists and said, how much could this fault move by? And geologists made an estimate of 8 meters. So they built this pipeline so that where it crossed this fault, if this fault moved by 8 meters, the pipeline would not break. Got this kind of dog leg in it, and it would just move to and fro on its little trolleys there, its little runners. And in 2002, an earthquake did occur on that very fault break, and it moved by something like 7.8 meters. And the pipeline just rolled to and fro in this tremendous, you know, ground-shaking incident, and it was undamaged. So instead of having a horrendous oil spill over Alaska and you know, a big disaster where all the oil supply was broken off, it's just business as usual. So there are things we can do. There's a big challenge ahead, but there are things we can do, and it's not all black. Okay, we'll finish up there. And we're going to start the practical with a test. And those of you who weren't asleep, who remember what I said, I'm sure will score highly.